Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 12:43, that is Pacific Standard Time, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term video audio for the various different asset classes. And today I think we should really kick off with Italian bonds, and I've got a really long-term chart here that is going back all the way to the early 1990s when bond yields in Italy were in the region of 13%. And isn't it interesting that today local currency bonds in Turkey and in Brazil are, you know, not that far off those levels. In fact, the Turkish bond yield, despite all the risk that is being priced into the market and all the discussion about the problems that the country faces, that the bond yield is still not at a level at which Italian bonds were trading in the 1990s. So that really does give us a picture of just how low interest rates are overall, because this is a obviously bonds are a relative value market. It is almost impossible to gauge value without being able to compare it against something. And certainly if we zoom in a little and look at what has been happening with government bonds in Italy, then we know that the yield doubled over the summer, got all the way up to 2%, and then we get at least some sign of buying in here today. Now, of course, the Italians have got their referendum on the reform of the Senate on Sunday, and that is a big question. It is very questionable whether Renzi is going to survive this, and whether Italy isn't going to have an election. That could open up the door for an additional populist vote overall. The bigger question overall is whether Italy, whether the EU is going to have one set of rules for large countries and one set of rules for small ones. If, in fact, an Italian bank goes bust, and the problem, of course, is that Italy has got an awful lot of banks. There have been recapitalizations that have been attempted. There have been bond equity swaps, and then what we are really waiting for is just how successful those are going to be. How is the market going to react if indeed Italy votes against the government? And quite apart from all of the risk that is currently in Italy, then there is risks elsewhere too. Because obviously in France, it is looking increasingly likely that the French electorate are going to get a decision to make about whether they want more of the same, which would be fiscal piety, or whether they want a populist solution, which would basically be voting for fiscal stimulus. One way or the other, that is going to be a very taut and probably aggressively fought debate overall, but it represents another potential milestone, another challenge for the status quo within Europe overall. I think one thing that is particularly interesting at the current juncture, because what we have certainly seen has been a quite a significant sell-off in US government debt, and perhaps more important than the exact level is the fact that this downtrend from early 2014 has now been broken. But you know, we can also be cognizant of the fact that this has been a very big move in a very short period of time. And in absolute terms, the yield is at 2.39% and Italian bonds yield 1.9%. And therefore, we have to ask a very simple question, and it is this: is there really more risk in treasuries than there is in BTPs? And if we can simply come up with, if we can even ask that question, then it would suggest that we have at least some kind of mispricing in the market. It is either that US bonds are too cheap or Italian bonds are too expensive. Well, I think we kind of know that Italian bonds are too expensive. They are 100% dependent on ECB buying. And that is a significant quantity of money that is flowing into bonds. Now, there is a certain amount of rebellion among the chattering classes in Germany, but the reality is that Germany has benefited more than any other country from the Eurozone. And the euro is, I think, it is not an unfair characterization to say that it is barely steady at just above the 105 level. So far, we have had a distinct absence of very clear upward dynamics. You can see the last very clear upward dynamic right on the edge of the chart on the left-hand side. And what we definitely have here is a little bit of indecision. Now, of course, there is the possibility that we're going to have a decision on Monday from Italy that will jar the complacency, because obviously the dollar has been rallying so very, very strongly already. A lot of bad news has been priced in for just about everywhere else, and a lot of good news has been priced in for the USA. So we could get a bit of a well, in this case, a sell the rumor, buy the news type scenario. I think that there is a risk that we get some dollar weakness, at least to unwind the short-term overbought condition that the dollar has developed, and against a large number of currencies. And Turkey is also starting to make is certainly making headlines in here right now, and part of the reason for that is because the lira has been accelerating lower, and we can see that the dollar accelerating higher against it. But there is a short-term overbought condition for the dollar, and it is well off its peak in here today. The potential for the central bank in Turkey to move in and hike interest rates in an aggressive manner to stem the decline in the currency is, I think, looking increasingly likely. And then when we look at, for example, an ETF. Well, it is not especially liquid, but the iShares MSCI Turkey ETF is UK listed in pounds, and it is right at the lower side of its of a 5-year range overall. So it wouldn't be at all surprising that we get a bounce. Now, if we're thinking in those terms, it's perhaps instructive to look at some of the other emerging markets. And Brazil, having turned in a storming performance so far this year, that when we talk about dollar strength, it is a relatively recent phenomenon overall, because the majority of emerging market currencies have been rallying in robust fashion for most of the year. In nominal terms, at least, the Brazilian market has broken its downtrend. If we look at the Brazilian market just on a currency adjusted basis, then we get a much better picture of how much it had been trending lower and how much it had rallied, and that it is now back in a region of potential support overall. The Russian index has obviously benefited from this week's decision by OPEC to cut back some of its supply overall, that they're going to take a million barrels of supply out of the market. And the Russian index has also broken a lengthy progression of lower rally highs. But it isn't just emerging markets in the oil producing sector that are doing this, that the Norwegian index is testing its highs, and the Norwegian currency, which has really been quite weak, has at least steadied up here in the region of 6.5, and that the major decline has probably already occurred. The Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund is talking about deploying an increasingly large proportion of its assets overall into equities, and those are the kinds of things that can really start to change a market. Now, we've had a very big move in the dollar, and that has weighed on gold. Gold prices have fallen back. And when we look at the weekly chart, then if it was going to remain consistent on the upside, it would have found support in the region of the 200-day moving average. And there were signs that it was doing that, but it failed in robust fashion after the election. And now a short-term oversold condition is evident, and even in the context of a market which has been trending lower since early July, then the potential for a bounce is increasing rather rapidly as prices come back. Now, if indeed this is a short-term low, it is for the bulls to prove. Gold has experienced some trend deterioration. It is if it is a low and it is going to reassert on the upside, then it will have to bounce. It will then, if it encounters resistance in the region of the moving average, which has now turned lower, then it will have to find support above $1,200 on the next pullback. Subsequently, it will have to sustain a move above $1,300 at a minimum in order to break the downtrend from July and to really confirm that demand has returned to dominance beyond short-term steadying. So it does have a lot of work to do, and it is not beyond the bounds of possibility. We certainly, from long experience of trading gold, know that it is capable of having some pretty swingeing pullbacks overall. So we simply, and more importantly perhaps, is that it is capable of lengthy pullbacks, lengthy periods of consolidation. And I think people who were trading it in the last decade will remember that it, on at least three occasions, went through 18-month consolidations before breaking upwards. And those consolidations were quite volatile. When we're informed of that kind of experience and trading, then this kind of volatility is perhaps not so surprising, although the severity of the decline has certainly been alarming. But we know what it has to do in order to confirm that demand is back in the driving seat. And but again, there isn't clear evidence of that yet, although the price was a little bit firmer in here today because the dollar was a little bit weaker overall. Now, platinum has been even has fallen even more, pulling back from a peak of $1,200 to $900, which is a substantial pullback, but it has bounced now from from that $900 area. Now, there is a rivetingly consistent progression of lower rally highs, and it will need to sustain a move above 1,000 in order to really confirm that demand is returning to dominance. But the prospect of a reversionary rally is increasing in here. Now, what we've also seen is that the industrial metals have been very strong indeed. But what I've also seen is that there are, and I think it is very interesting, I've seen a number of news stories where people have been talking about a massive pullback in iron ore prices. And I really just don't see any evidence of it. When we look at the iron ore China imports, then what I'm presented with at least is a downtrend which lost momentum, had base formation characteristics over the last couple of years, and then broke upwards. And so far that breakout has been sustained. Now, when we look at the chart, then we can discount a lot of the media attention. We know that iron ore prices have broken out, and that coking coal has been on an incredible run. That I think I'm going to pull up the right one. It has done nothing but go up until at least November. And that is a very large move relative to what we've seen previously. And in fact, it has been a number of years since we saw a rally like this. and it's very technically based in fact that there has been just a shortage of coking coal. But of course, the move in iron ore and the move in coal has been enormously beneficial for the miners. And so, Vale, which had probably been more depressed than the Rio or BHP Billiton, is back on a recovery trajectory and had a swingeing pullback overall, falling from $35 in 2011 back to 170. So it has done spectacularly well so far this year, but by looking at the chart, we can also tell that this is not late, that it has gone up a lot because it was so very depressed, but that it could potentially go quite a bit further. When So then, if we also look at, for example, Whitehaven Coal, which has got that similar trajectory overall, that it had also had an enormous pullback, and there were very large questions about the sustainability of the Australian coal sector. And yet, coking coal is an essential ingredient in creating steel. So we've had a really quite a sharp pullback, and it does look like now that some of these coal companies might consolidate. In the US, there is Natural Resource Partners, which is a limited partnership and has got a rather chunky yield and has been trending rather consistently higher overall. Even when we start looking outside of the iron ore and coal sectors, then there is increasing evidence that it is that we're getting a return to demand dominance overall, that commonality is increasing right across the sector. Now, there is two ways that we can think about this. When we look at the pickup in demand for very basic resource type companies like coal and iron ore, then that's generally a reflection of improving economic growth overall. And we have evidence of that US growth is getting better, that European growth is modest, but it is improving, that Chinese growth is coming in on target. And then we also have the prospect of fiscal stimulus. And the fact that we are potentially getting fiscal stimulus at a time in the US where you have almost full employment, well, that is going to create robust demand overall, but it is also likely to create potentially bubbly valuations in a number of asset classes that you're sort of stimulating at the wrong part of the cycle. Now, if that is indeed the case, then there is the potential for a substantial rally in resources overall, because demand will pick up, and we've had a massive rationalization within the industry. And generally speaking, that is pretty consistent with the latter stages of a big bull market, because interest rates are beginning to rise, and they're rising because economic growth is coming in a bit better. That economies have recovered, balance sheets have been repaired, and the consumer is beginning to come back in and borrow. There is also the additional prospect of a deregulation, and that would be rather beneficial overall for the banking sector. And if we look at say banking sectors overall, and we look at the world rather than just the USA, then what we're seeing is that it isn't just the USA is doing better. It is banking sectors globally are turning to outperformance once more. The European banks, which I think many people have kind of written off, and really for with not without due justification, but I think it is very worth considering the fact that the European Banking Index, having trended lower and fallen from 160 to 75 is now trading back above the 200-day moving average and bounced this week. So what we can certainly say is that the ECB is buying. We've seen that in Italian yields. German yields also compressed additionally in here today. And that also it tells us that there are certainly risks to the Eurozone. And potentially those risks are most acute in the political sphere. Within the monetary sphere, Mario Draghi is still in charge, and he is doing whatever it takes on the monetary front to provide liquidity, at least to temper the risk that is outstanding in on the political front. And it will be a political decision overall whether the EU or the Eurozone or the Euro, in fact, eventually breaks up. It's unlikely to be a monetary decision, and that is, of course, why it is so important to monitor these political machinations right across the region. When we look at the banking sector, then it could benefit enormously from deregulation. It hasn't been able to fulfill its role as a provider of liquidity for over a decade. So people own those the banking sector those shares for yield and security. They haven't been able to fulfill either because of the aftermath of the credit crisis. If we do get deregulation and we do get fiscal stimulus, then there is the potential that the banking sector recover, that they'll their margins will improve, that they'll be able to open up additional business units, and then that their profits will improve and they'll be able to start paying dividends again. So, and quite apart from anything else, they're cheap. They are at they're considerably below where their peaks were previously. And one of the things that has been certainly observable over the last week in particular has been the relative weakness of technology shares, that we have seen a substantial number of weekly key reversals. And that has weighed on the Nasdaq 100. So it has pulled back, but we can see clearly that it is still trending or still trading above the 200-day moving average, and it overall consolidating above the underlying trading range. It's also worth considering that prices are pretty much in the region of the 2000 peak, and that as long as they are trading above 4500, I think we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. There is also an argument that we're getting rotation, that that Apple has been really quite steady overall, whereas Nvidia has just begun to pull back. And I actually haven't looked at Nvidia today, and I haven't updated the chart in the chart library yet either. But it was a little bit steadier in here today. It's currently trading around 88.46. So, we are seeing some evidence that investors are beginning to look beyond what has been doing very well so far this year. And they're starting to look at things that are reasonably cheap. What we have also seen is that some of the shares that have that performed best coming out of the credit crisis are now trending lower. Nike, Starbucks, and Disney kind of fall into that category, and they have work to do. They could be among the bigger beneficiaries overall of a fiscal stimulus, but they will need to break medium-term progressions of lower rally highs in order to really confirm that demand is back in the driver's seat. If you and then when we look at the consumer discretionary, then that's where we see some evidence of the kinds of shares that are benefiting from the prospect of fiscal stimulus. It broke to a new high last week, and And while it hasn't improved on that performance this week, there is the potential that we are in the latter stages of what has been a lengthy period of consolidation overall. And in this sector, just like we've seen with so many others, that the surprises over the last year and a half have been on the downside, and that now there is the potential that we do get surprises on the upside. Something that I think really is worth considering is that the S&P 500 has been ranging for quite a while already. That we have had, this is not the first time that we've had a very large consolidation. That if we look at all the data that we have, that we get these long ranges going from 1929 through to 1952. Then we get a big bull market, and we get another big range from 1969 all the way through to 1980, and we get another big bull market, and then we go from 1999 to 2013 in a big range, and now the market has broken out again. Now, what we can definitely see from these previous bull markets is that they are punctuated on occasion by large pullbacks. And we haven't had a large pullback yet in this bull market. That we have been through a lengthy consolidation overall. And if we were to just simply look at the chart and strip away absolutely everything else, then we have had a breakout, we've had a rather orderly pullback to the region of the upper side of the underlying range, and now the market has broken upwards at a very minimum. A move, sustained move below 2100 would really be required to question potential for additional upside. Now, when we look at the bond market, there is perhaps the most important characteristic overall is that the bond market is orders of magnitude larger than stocks. That we are starting to see some of the money moving out of bonds and into equities. It is that big move, and that you can't have a big bull market without liquidity. If people are trying to hedge their exposure to inflation, then the stock market is a good way to do that. That you'll get at least nominal price appreciation. And all you have to do is look at a country, for example, like Venezuela. And I'm not for one moment predicting that we're going to have that kind of hyperinflation. But the stock market reflects the domestic inflationary market. And that's just perfect proof that stock markets do give us some hedge against inflation overall. But this has already been a big pullback in the bond market. And people have been conditioned by this market. That if you think about it, the average age of a trader is 29. And this bull market has been in evidence for 35 years. So you would have to be pretty long in the tooth to remember a bond bear market. That obviously this is a total return chart, and pension funds are now, who are the big owners of bonds, are total return investors. So the buy the dip strategy has worked repeatedly for decades, and it will have to stop working to confirm that this bull market is over. But what we know now is that this is now a larger pullback. It is the largest pullback in the context of the 35-year bull market. That is a major trend inconsistency. We have now had the massive reaction against the prevailing uptrend. The question, of course, will be, are we going to get right-hand extension, like we see, and this is certainly a topic that we cover in the chart seminar, or does the price come back much faster? But in order to reassert demand dominance overall, then it will have to sustain a move back above the 200-day moving average. So I think that we could be set up for another opportunity to short into this market after we get a relief rally overall. And that is possible because there are so many people will be looking to buy the dip and be looking at this spread between Europe and the US and thinking that there is something really quite wrong with how Italian bonds, for example, are being priced. So I think that is that we are likely to get some back and forth, and not least because the new president in the US is not inaugurated until January 20th, and we're only on the 2nd of December. So that there is plenty of room for trading around these events between now and then. And this is, I think, one of the more important charts overall, because one of the things that could really change valuations is technological innovation. And I think there is no coincidence that the velocity of money has been trending lower since 1997. That really was when the internet and technology overall gained traction. And when we have data for this going back over 50 years, and the velocity of money has never been lower, that virtually ensures that the supply of money is going to be higher, because central banking 101 is so simple. It is that you need to have enough money in the market to ensure the potential for economic growth. And if the number of transactions and the velocity of money is deteriorating, then the quantity of money has to increase. And it has been trending lower, and this trend is accelerating lower because the pace of technological innovation is also accelerating. Now, that represents an enormous challenge. That is also part of the reason why we have had such a lurch to populism, because so many people have been left behind by the economic system such as we have it. It is, I think, very arguable. I suspect someone is going to win the Nobel Prize for highlighting the fact that our economic statistics are not particularly well suited to measuring the kind of economic activity that is actually going on in the world today. And that is an enormous challenge, because if velocity of money continues to deteriorate, and there is every reason to expect that it will, that automation is happening at an increasing rate, that there are major companies, manufacturing companies in places like China and Bangladesh, and a number of the very large, low-cost manufacturing centers that want to be fully automated within a decade. And that would suggest that we're not just going to have velocity of money declining in the US, but that it is going to start declining everywhere. And the only way to really start moving velocity of money is to put more money in people's hands. Giving it to banks and hoping that they will lend it out is perhaps, that we already have evidence that it doesn't improve the velocity of money, and it doesn't create growth overall. That perhaps one of the big solutions, and potentially unpalatable ones, is fiscal stimulus, because it puts money exactly where it needs to be. It needs to be in the hands of individuals so that they can go out and spend it. And of course, that also means that we need to get people back to work. So there are enormous challenges, but the reality is that because of technological innovation and the fact that we are getting improving governance, that just this week, and I think this really is a fantastic example, Reliance Industries rolled out their 4G network in India, and I have a chart that I think is really interesting, and I've saved it, and it's just going to take one moment to load. I took it down last night from Akamai Technologies, And what it is a chart of is the penetration of 2G, 3G, and 4G. And it is taking a long time to load. 2G, 4G, 2G, tough 4G internet connectivity via mobile devices. You can see that North America is pretty yellow. That it means that it is the vast majority have at least 3G, and obviously then the major centers will have 4G connectivity. But South Korea, the whole country has 4G. Japan is very fast internet connectivity, so is Scandinavia. But India is rather ochre, and down here on this bar, it really highlights the fact that the vast majority of the country is on 2G. But Reliance has just, in the last couple of weeks, opened up its 4G network. That people the cheapest plan, which is I think it's 100 megs a month of download, but free downloads at night, and is only something like 22p a month. That you can get a smartphone for £60, and that low price virtually ensures that it is going to be ubiquitous within the year. And you can imagine, and it is really offering people the difference between dial-up and high-speed internet overnight to a population that has already signed up. I think it's like 400 million people have already signed up for it. That's the equivalent of the entire population of Europe getting broadband within a month. When you start to think about it in those terms, then the potential for India and for other countries that adopt a similar model, that they can skip just huge stages in their development. There will be no need for retail branch networks to be built out in the countryside. That there may be no need for, that the big supermarket chains have been clamoring to get into the market, and they might be just completely have missed the boat, because we could just go straight to e-shopping in India. And of course, Google announced over the summer that they want to train 2 million Android programmers in India over the next few years, and that's a project that's going to be a lot easier with ready access to broadband overall. So, and of course, that is it's an enormous development for India, but of course, this isn't just limited in potential, that it is just simply be done now, but that it is representative of the trend that your cutting-edge technologies are not—they're no longer limited to the developed world overall. That what we are now getting is that these technologies become global instantly. So that not only do we have the potential for a wall of money to come out of the bond market, that and for interest rates to rise overall, which would, I think, in many respects, it would help to improve the quality of capital allocation, because we wouldn't have the same casino-like environment overall. But the rolling on of technological innovation and then the rolling out of that innovation to the entire world simultaneously will help to really foster a new economy overall. That there will be new business models, there will be new businesses that will advance, and that we're going to have upwards of 2 billion people entering the global economy, and that over the next 30 years, and they have a better chance now than ever before to reach their productive capacity. And that is, I think, one of the reasons to be really very bullish indeed, that we are getting signs that we're in the latter stages of this portion, at least, of a big bull market, and we could have a partial acceleration because of the liquidity issues that or the it's not an issue, the liquidity potential that could come out of fiscal stimulus and a sell-off in bonds. Now, if we do get fiscal stimulus, then that is going to raise a longer-term question about how some of that debt is going to get paid back. That is potentially what we could be thinking about in a few years from now. But right now, I think it is looking increasingly bullish that it is sectors like resources, the banking sector, and the defense sector will be doing better next year. And obviously, it is that companies that did spectacularly well in 2016 are unlikely to be able to repeat that performance in 2017, and that over the next few weeks we should really be looking for those shares that are oversold, that have been among the worst performers this year. And when we look at that list, it is peppered with biotech shares. Biotech has been among the worst performers this year. It hit a peak in July of last year, and we do not yet have evidence that the broad sector has been able to return to a position of demand dominance beyond the short term. But Gilead Sciences, which really was among the best performers, have been trending lower since July of 2015, and there is a rivetingly consistent progression of lower rally highs there. Whereas, smaller companies overall have been doing better, and there is increasing evidence that we are getting better performance overall in immuno-oncology. That would appear to be the sector where there is real results starting to come through, that these that attacking cancer and getting the body to fight it back and teaching the immune system to really combat cancer is coming through with real results. And that is something that and that is where we're seeing relative strength right now within the biotech sector. And it's just another example of just the feverish pace of technological innovation, and that cancer is one of the most intractable problems that we have, that these kinds of companies are doing something that is very, very different from the big pharmaceutical companies. Something that I'm increasingly cognizant of is that the healthcare sector has got this has been ranging now for a year and a half, and this has been a considerable loss of momentum and loss of consistency from a sector that was doing spectacularly well. And big pharmaceuticals tend to invest in big cures that cure lots and lots of people. But so they have to invest in the home run because the cost of developing new drugs has been rising exponentially for decades, so that now it costs billions and billions of dollars to create one new drug. They're betting on home runs. That isn't really how the biotech sector is working. They're coming up with new drugs that can be infinitely tailored, so that we get personalized medicine. And that is a very different business model overall than conventional pharmaceuticals. So, and I think that difference is going to increasingly delineate the winners from the losers within the sector overall. And when we look at, and I think today in particular, we really should just, I'm going to finish by looking at the pound. The pound is currently engaged in a reversionary rally overall. It has been an incredible decline since 2014 from 170 down to below 120. And we are getting a reversionary rally. There is increasing optimism that the UK and the EU can settle their differences and part on amicable terms. There is, I think we're still going to have months of brinksmanship, and nobody yet knows exactly how this exit is going to occur and to what extent it is going to happen, and indeed whether the EU is even going to be there by the time the negotiations are completed. So with those uncertainties, that the uncertainties are more on the Eurozone's front than on the UK's front, and there you then have the possibility for the euro to decline versus the pound, and the pound to rally. And I'm showing it here versus the dollar, of course, because the dollar has obviously done extraordinarily well of late. So it is probably more appropriate to look at the pound versus the euro. And the pound is now testing its has unwound its oversold condition relative to the trend mean versus the euro. It would probably be required for the euro to deteriorate additionally for the to really start to allow the pound to break that, or to break the euro's uptrend overall. And I think with that, I'm going to leave you for the weekend, and I'm going to wish all the best to all of you.